called How to Be Clever, which teaches readers how to calculate the day of the week for any date in history, how to memorize a deck of cards, and how to scam an IQ test. The book is about making people think you're brainy without actually increasing your intelligence, he told me. The problem is I haven't written very much because I always have more important things to do, like watch cartoons. If I tried to write a serious book on how to improve your life, I'd be rubbish at it, because I haven't got the faintest idea how to improve my life. The favorite to take Ben's title at the World Championship was Dr. Günter Karsten, the balding, angular 43-year-old godfather of German memory sport, who had won every German national contest since 1998. Günter showed up wearing what I learned is his standard uniform, an imposing pair of black earmuffs and metallic sunglasses whose insides have been completely taped over except for two small pinholes. Extraneous stimuli, as Günter calls them, are the memorizer's bête noir. A retired Danish mnemonist used to compete wearing horse blinders. He also wore a gold belt buckle embossed with his initials, a gold chain over his tight white t-shirt, and black sailor pants that flared at the bottom. Günter informed me that in college he was a photo model for Nissan cars, and depending on how you squinted, he looked like the villain in a James Bond movie or an aging figure skater. He was in terrific physical shape, and was, I would soon learn, a fierce competitor. Despite the fact that one of his legs is slightly shorter than the other, from a childhood bone disease, he regularly races in and wins track events for middle-aged men. He was carrying around with him a locked, shiny metal suitcase filled with between 20 and 30 decks of playing cards, which he planned to memorize. He wouldn't tell me the exact number for fear it would get back to Ben Pridmore. The actual competition took place in a large oak-paneled room in one of Oxford's storied old buildings, with tall Gothic windows and oversized portraits of the 3rd Earl of Lichfield and the 14th Earl of Derby. The room was arranged no differently than it had been during the school year, when it was used to administer exams to Oxford undergraduates. There were 4 dozen desks, each of which had a 6-inch-tall digital stopwatch clamped to it, which would be used for the last and most exciting event of the contest, speed cards, when the competitors raced to commit a single deck of playing cards to memory as fast as possible. Unlike the U.S. Championship, which has just 5 events, none lasting longer than 15 minutes, the World Memory Championship is frequently referred to as a mental decathlon. Its 10 events, called disciplines, span 3 grueling days, and each tests the competitors' memories in a slightly different way. Contestants have to memorize a previously unpublished poem spanning several pages, pages of random words, record 280 in 15 minutes, lists of binary digits, record 4,140 in 30 minutes, shuffled decks of playing cards, a list of historical dates, and names and faces. Some disciplines, called speed events, test how much the contestants can memorize in 5 minutes, record 405 digits. 2 marathon disciplines test how many decks of cards and random digits they can memorize in an hour, records 2,080 digits and 27 decks of cards. The first World Memory Championship was held at the posh Athenaeum Club in London in 1991. I thought, this is insane, recalls Tony Buzan. We have crossword championships, we have Scrabble championships, we have chess, bridge, poker, draughts, canasta, and go championships. We have science fair championships. And for the biggest, the most fundamental of all human cognitive processes, memory, there's no championship. He also knew that the idea of a world memory champion would be an irresistible draw for the media, and a savvy way to promote his books on mind training. With the help of his friend Raymond Keane, a British chess grandmaster who writes the daily chess column for The Times, London, Buzan sent out letters to a handful of people who he knew were involved in memory training, and ran an ad in The Times advertising the contest. 7 people showed up, including a psychiatric nurse named Creighton Carvello, who had memorized the telephone number of every Smith in the Middlesbrough phone book, and another person named Bruce Balmer, who had set a record for memorizing 2,000 foreign words in a single day. Several of the competitors wore tuxedos. The contestants no longer adhere to such a strict dress code, but everything else about the championship has gotten far more serious since 1991. What began as a one-day contest has now expanded to fill an entire weekend. Of all the disciplines in a three-day memory decathlon, the first one of the first day, the poem, is the most universally dreaded. Because of my own faltering efforts to memorize poetry, it was the one event that I wanted to watch most closely. Every year, Gunter lobbies to have the event stricken from the contest, or at least replaced with rules that are more, as he puts it, objective. But poetry is where memorization began, and to cut it from the championship because a few of the competitors find it difficult would run counter to the competition's underlying premise that memorization is a creative and humanizing endeavor. So every year, a new, previously unpublished poem is commissioned for the World Championship. For the first few years of the competition, in the early 90s, the poem was written by the British poet laureate Ted Hughes, whom Tony Buzan describes as an old friend. Since Hughes's death in 1998, the poem has been written by Buzan himself. This year's 108-line free verse offering, titled Miserare, came from a collection titled Requiem for Ted. It began, "With most things in the universe, I am happy. Supernovas, the Horsehead Nebula, the Crab, the light years big clouds that are the womb of stars." It went on to list the many things Tony Buzan was happy about, including God's freezing balls, and ended, "I am not happy. That Ted is dead." The competitors had 15 minutes to memorize as many lines as possible, and then a half hour to write them on a blank sheet of paper. In order to receive full credit for a line, it had to be rendered perfectly, down to each capital letter and punctuation mark. Competitors who failed to underscore just how not happy the author was, or who mistakenly thought that Ted was dead without a capital D, would get only half the total points for that line. The question of how to best memorize a piece of text, or a speech, has vexed mnemonists for millennia. The earliest memory treatises described two types of recollection, memoria rerum and memoria verborum, memory for things and memory for words. When approaching a text or a speech, one could try to remember the gist, or one could try to remember verbatim. The Roman rhetoric teacher Quintilian looked down on memoria verborum on the grounds that creating such a vast number of images was not only inefficient, since it would require a gargantuan memory palace, but also unstable. If your memory for a speech hinged on knowing every word, then not only did you have a lot more to remember, but if you forgot a single word, you could end up trapped in a room of your memory palace staring at a blank wall, lost and unable to move on. Cicero agreed that the best way to memorize a speech is point by point, not word by word, by employing memoria rerum. In his De Oratore, he suggests that an orator delivering a speech should make one image for each major topic he wants to cover, and place each of those images at a locus. Indeed, the word topic comes from the Greek word topos, or place. The phrase, in the first place, is a vestige from the art of memory. Perfect recall of words is something our brains simply aren't very good at, a fact famously illustrated in the Congressional Watergate hearings of 1973. In his testimony before the Senate Watergate Investigating Committee, President Richard Nixon's counsel, John Dean, reported to the congressman on the contents of dozens of meetings related to the cover-up of the break-in. To the president's chagrin and the committee's delight, Dean was able to repeat verbatim many conversations that had taken place in the Oval Office, His recollections were so detailed and seemingly so precise that reporters took to calling him the human tape recorder. At the time, it hadn't yet been revealed that there had been an actual tape recorder in the Oval Office recording the conversations that Dean had reconstructed from memory. While the rest of the country took note of the political implications of those tape recordings, the psychologist Ulrich Neisse saw them as a valuable data trove. Neisse compared the transcripts of the recordings with Dean's testimony and analyzed what Dean's memory got right and what it got wrong. Not only did Dean not remember specific quotes correctly, that is to say, verborum, he often didn't even properly remember the gist of what had been discussed, rerum. But even when his memories were wrong in isolated episodes, notes Neisse, there is a sense in which he was altogether right. The major themes of his testimony were all accurate. Nixon wanted the cover-up to succeed. He was pleased when it went well. He was troubled when it began to unravel. He was perfectly willing to consider illegal activities if they would extend his power or confound his enemies. John Dean did not misrepresent, argues Neisse. He did get the details wrong, but he got the important stuff right. We all do the same thing when we try to recount conversations, because without special training, our memories tend to only pay attention to the big picture. It makes sense that our brains would work like that. The brain is a costly organ. Though it accounts for only 2% of the body's mass, it uses up a fifth of all the oxygen we breathe, and it's where a quarter of our glucose gets burned. The brain is the most energetically expensive piece of equipment in our body, and has been ruthlessly honed by natural selection to be efficient at the tasks for which it evolved. One might say that the whole point of our nervous system, from the sensory organs that feed information to the glob of neurons that interprets it, is to develop a sense of what is happening in the present and what will happen in the future, so that we can respond in the best possible way. Strip away the emotions, the philosophizing, the neuroses, and the dreams, and our brains, in the most reductive sense, are fundamentally prediction and planning machines. And to work efficiently, they have to find order in the chaos of possible memories. From the vast amounts of data pouring in through the senses, our brains must quickly sift out which information is likely to have some bearing on the future, attend to that, and ignore the noise. Much of the chaos that our brains filter out is words, because more often than not, the actual language that conveys an idea is just window dressing. What matters is the res, the meaning of those words. And that's what our brains are so good at remembering. In real life, it's rare that anyone is asked to recall ad verbum outside of congressional depositions and the poetry event at an international memory competition. Until the last tick of history's clock, cultural transmission meant oral transmission, and poetry, passed from mouth to ear, was the principal medium of moving information across space and from one generation to the next. Oral poetry was not simply a way of telling lovely or important stories or of flexing the imagination. It was, argues the classicist Eric Havelock, a massive repository of useful knowledge, a sort of encyclopedia of ethics, politics, history, and technology which the effective citizen was required to learn as the core of his educational equipment. The great oral works transmitted a shared cultural heritage, held in common not on bookshelves, but in brains. Professional memorizers have existed in oral cultures throughout the world to transmit that heritage through the generations. In India, an entire class of priests was charged with memorizing the Vedas with perfect fidelity. In pre-Islamic Arabia, people known as rawis were often attached to poets as official memorizers. The Buddha's teachings were passed down in an unbroken chain of oral tradition for 4 centuries until they were committed to writing in Sri Lanka in the 1st century BC. and for centuries, a group of hired tape recorders called Tana'im, literally reciters, memorized the oral law on behalf of the Jewish community. The most famous of the Western tradition's oral works, and the first to have been systematically studied, were Homer's Odyssey and Iliad. These two poems, possibly the first to have been written down in the Greek alphabet, had long been held up as literary archetypes. However, even as they were celebrated as the models to which all literature should aspire, Homer's masterworks had also long been the source of scholarly unease. The earliest modern critics sensed that they were somehow qualitatively different from everything that came after, even a little strange. For one thing, both poems were oddly repetitive in the way they referred to characters. Odysseus was always clever Odysseus. Dawn was always rosy-fingered. Why would someone write like that? Sometimes the epithets seemed completely off-key. Why call the murderer of Agamemnon blameless Aegisthus? Why refer to swift-footed Achilles even when he was sitting down? Or to laughing Aphrodite even when she was in tears? In terms of both structure and theme, the Odyssey and Iliad were also oddly formulaic, to the point of predictability. The same narrative units, gathering armies, heroic shields, challenges between rivals, pop up again and again, only with different characters and different circumstances. In the context of such finely spun, deliberate masterpieces, these quirks seemed hard to explain. At the heart of the unease about these earliest works of literature were two fundamental questions. First, how could Greek literature have been born ex nihilo with two masterpieces? Surely a few less perfect stories must have come before, and yet these two were among the first on record. And second, who exactly was their author? Or was it authors? There were no historical records of Homer, and no trustworthy biography of the man exists beyond a few self-referential hints embedded in the texts themselves. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was one of the first modern critics to suggest that Homer might not have been an author in the contemporary sense of a single person who sat down and wrote a story and then published it for others to read. In his 1781 Essay on the Origin of Languages, the Swiss philosopher suggested that the Odyssey and Iliad might have been written only in men's memories. Somewhat later, they were laboriously collected in writing. Though that was about as far as his inquiry into the matter went. Also writing in the 18th century, an English diplomat and archaeologist named Robert Wood suggested that Homer was illiterate and that his works had to have been committed to memory. It was a revolutionary theory, but Wood couldn't back it up with a hypothesis that explained how Homer might have pulled off such an astounding mnemonic feat. In 1795, the German philologist Friedrich August Wolff argued for the first time that not only were Homer's works not written down by Homer, but they also weren't even by Homer. They were, rather, a loose collection of songs transmitted by generations of Greek bards, and only redacted in their present written form at some later date. In 1920, an 18-year-old scholar named Milman Parry took up the question of Homeric authorship as his master's thesis at the University of California, Berkeley. He suggested that the reason Homer's epics seemed unlike other literature was because they were unlike other literature. Parry had discovered what Wood and Wolff had missed. The evidence that the poems had been transmitted orally was right there in the text itself. All those stylistic quirks, including the formulaic and recurring plot elements and the bizarrely repetitive epithets, clever Odysseus and gray-eyed Athena, that had always perplexed readers, were actually like thumbprints left by a potter. Material evidence of how the poems had been crafted. They were mnemonic aids that helped the bards fit the meter and pattern of the line, and remember the essence of the poems. The greatest author of antiquity was actually, Parry argued, just one of a long tradition of oral poets that composed wholly without the aid of writing. Parry realized that if you were setting out to create memorable poems, the Odyssey and the Iliad were exactly the kinds of poems you'd create. It's said that clichés are the worst sin a writer can commit, but to an oral bard, they were essential. The very reason that clichés so easily seep into our speech and writing, their insidious memorability, is exactly why they played such an important role in oral storytelling. And the Odyssey and Iliad, excuse the cliché, are riddled with them. In a culture dependent on memory, it's critical, in the words of Walter Eng, that people think memorable thoughts. The brain best remembers things that are repeated, rhythmic, rhyming, structured, and above all else, easily visualized. The principles that the oral bards discovered as they sharpened their stories through telling and retelling were the same basic mnemonic principles that psychologists rediscovered when they began conducting their first scientific experiments on memory around the turn of the 20th century. Words that rhyme are much more memorable than words that don't. Concrete nouns are easier to remember than abstract nouns. Dynamic images are more memorable than static images. Alliteration aids memory. A striped skunk making a slam dunk is a stickier thought than a patterned mustelid engaging in athletic activity. The most useful of all the mnemonic tricks employed by the bards was song. As anyone who has ever found himself chanting, "By Menon," can attest, if you can turn a set of words into a jingle, they can become exceedingly difficult to knock out of your head. Finding patterns and structure in information is how our brains extract meaning from the world, and putting words to music and rhyme are a way of adding extra levels of pattern and structure to language. It's the reason Homeric bards sang their epic oral poems, and the reason that the Torah is marked up with little musical notations, and the reason we teach kids the alphabet in a song and not as 26 individual letters. Song is the ultimate structuring device for language. After moving to Harvard and becoming an assistant professor, Parry took an unconventional turn in his work. Rather than hunkering down with old Greek texts, the young classicist took off for Yugoslavia in search of the last bards who still practiced a form of oral poetry resembling the Homeric arts. He returned to Cambridge with thousands of recordings that formed the basis for a new branch of academic research into oral traditions. In his fieldwork, Parry found that rather than transmitting the text itself from bard to bard and generation to generation, the contemporary Balkan rhapsodists, presumably like their ancient Homeric predecessors, would impart a set of formulaic rules and constraints that allowed the bard, any bard, to reconstruct the poem each time he recited it. Each retelling of the story was not exactly like the one that came before, but it was close. When the Slavic bards were asked whether they repeated their songs exactly, they responded, "word for word and line for line." And yet when recordings of two performances were held up against each other, they clearly were different. Words changed, lines moved around, passages disappeared. The Slavic bards weren't being overconfident. They simply had no concept of verbatim recall. Not that this should have been surprising. Without writing, there is no way to check whether something has been repeated exactly. The variability that is built into the poetry of oral traditions allows the bard to adapt the material to the audience, but it also allows more memorable versions of the poem to arise. Folklorists have compared oral poems to pebbles worn down by the water. They're made smooth over many retellings as the harder-to-remember pieces get chipped away or made easier to retain and repeat. Irrelevant digressions are forgotten. Long or rare words are avoided, Between imagery, alliteration, and having to fit the meter of the line, the epic bard usually doesn't have that many possible words to choose from. The structure writes the poem. Indeed, work by Parry's successors has found that virtually every word in the Odyssey and the Iliad fits into some sort of schema or pattern that made the poem easier to remember. It's no coincidence that the art of memory was supposedly invented by Simonides at exactly the moment when the use of writing was on the rise in ancient Greece, around the 5th century BC. Memory was no longer something that could be taken for granted, as it had been during Greece's pre-literate epoch. The old techniques of the Homeric bards, of rhythm and formula, were no longer adequate to holding in mind the new and complex thoughts that people were beginning to think. The original oral performance, with its poetry, was stripped of functional purpose and relegated to the secondary role of entertainment, one which it always had, but which now became its sole purpose, writes Havelock. No longer burdened by the requirements of oral transmission, poetry was free to become art. By the time the author of the Ad Herennium sat down to compose his handbook on oration in the 1st century BC, writing was already a centuries-old craft, as fundamental a part of the Roman world as computers are a part of our own. The poems produced by his contemporaries, Virgil, Horace, and Ovid all wrote their masterworks within a century of the Ad Herennium, lived on the page. Each word was painstakingly selected, the product of a single artist expressing his singular vision. And once set down, those words were considered inviolable. If you were going to try to commit such poetry to memory, memoria verborum was what was called for. Rerum simply wouldn't do. The anonymous author of the Ad Herennium suggests that the best method for remembering poetry ad verbum is to repeat a line 2 or 3 times before trying to see it as a series of images. This is more or less the method that Gunter Karsten uses in the poem competition. He assigns every single word to a root point. But this method has a glaring problem. There are lots of words that simply can't be visualized. What does an "and" look like? Or a "the"? Some 2,000 years ago, Metrodorus of Skepsis, a Greek contemporary of Cicero's, offered a solution to the quandary of how to see the unseeable. Metrodorus developed a system of shorthand images that would stand in for conjunctions, articles, and other syntactical connectors. It allowed him to memorize anything he read or heard verbatim. Indeed, Metrodorus's library of symbols seems to have been widely used in ancient Greece. The Ad Herennium mentions that most of the Greeks who have written on memory have taken the course of listing images that correspond to a great many words, so that persons who wish to learn these images by heart would have them ready without expending effort in search of them. Though Gunter doesn't use Metrodorus's symbols, which unfortunately have been lost to history, he has created his own dictionary of images for each of the 200 most common words that can't easily be visualized. And is a circle. And rhymes with rund, which means round in German. The is someone walking on his knees. D, a German word for the, rhymes with knie, the German word for knee. When the poem reaches a period, he hammers a nail into that locus. Gunter could just as easily be memorizing a VCR repair manual as a Shakespearean sonnet. In fact, a VCR repair manual would probably be a good deal easier, since it is filled with concrete, easily visualized words like button, television, and plug. The challenge of memorizing poetry is its abstractness. What do you do with words like ephemeral or self that are impossible to see? Gunter's method of creating an image for the unimaginable is a very old one. To visualize a similarly sounding or punning word in its place. The 14th century English theologian and mathematician Thomas Bradwarden, who was later appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, took this kind of verbatim memorization to its highest and most absurd level of development. He described a means of memoria syllabarum, or memory by syllables, which could be used to memorize words that were hard to visualize. Bradwarden's system involved breaking the word into its constituent syllables and then creating an image for each syllable based on another word that begins with that syllable. For example, if one wanted to remember the syllable ab, one would picture an abbot. For ba, one might visualize a crossbowman, a balistarius. When strung together, a chain of these syllables becomes a kind of rebus puzzle. The Swedish pop group ABBA could be recalled as an abbot getting shot by a crossbow. This process of transforming words into images involves a kind of remembering by forgetting. In order to memorize a word by its sound, its meaning has to be completely dismissed. Bradwarden could translate even the most pious benediction into a preposterous scene. To remember the topic sentence of a sermon that begins, Benedictus Dominus qui per, he'd see the sainted Benedictine dancing to his left with a white cow with super red teats, who holds a partridge, while with his right hand he either mangles or caresses Saint Dominic. The art of memory was, from its origins, always a bit risque. Preoccupied with Gothic and sometimes downright lewd imagery, it was bound to come in for harsh criticism from the prudes eventually. It's amazing, in a way, that the casual marriage of the reverent and irreverent that Bradwarden practiced in his imagination was not more upsetting to some of the more priggish clergy. When the moralistic attack finally came, it was led by the 16th century Puritan Reverend William Perkins of Cambridge. He decried the art of memory as idolatrous and impious because it calls up absurd thoughts, insolent, prodigious, and the like, which stimulate and light up depraved carnal affections. Carnal, indeed. Perkins was particularly steamed by Peter of Ravenna's admission that he used the lustful image of a young woman to excite his memory. Of the 10 events in the World Memory Championship, the poem has bred the greatest number of different strategies. But broadly speaking, mental athletes take two general tacks, which happen to segregate the pool of competitors fairly neatly by gender. While Gunther and most of the other men on the circuit subscribe to a methodical strategy, the women tend to approach the challenge in a more emotional way. 15-year-old Karina Droschkel, an Austrian in a red t-shirt and matching red socks and red baseball cap, told me she can't memorize a text unless she understands what it means. Even more than that, she has to understand how it feels. She breaks the poem into small chunks and then assigns a series of emotions to each short segment. Rather than associate the words with images, she associates them with feelings. I feel how the writer feels, what he is meaning. I imagine whether he's happy or sad, she told me in the hallway outside the competition hall. This is not dissimilar from how actors are taught to memorize scripts. Many actors will tell you that they break their lines into units they call beats, each of which involves some specific intention or goal on the character's part, which they train themselves to empathize with. This technique, known as method acting, was pioneered in Russia by Konstantin Stanislavski around the turn of the last century. Stanislavski was interested in these techniques not for their mnemonic potential, but rather as tools to help the actor more realistically depict his character. But method acting is a technique for giving a line more associational hooks to hang on, by embedding it in a context of both emotional and physical cues. Method acting is a way of making words memorable. Indeed, studies have found that if you ask someone to memorize a sentence like, pick up a pen, it's much more likely to stick if the person literally picks up a pen as they're learning the sentence. Ultimately, Günther ended up losing the poetry event to Karina Droschkel, and losing the championship as well. The top prize went to one of his protégés, a quiet and intensely focused 18-year-old Bavarian law student named Clemens Mayer, who spoke only choppy English and made it clear that he had no interest in practicing the language on me. After botching the spoken numbers and names and faces events, Ben Pridmore landed in fourth place overall, lowering the brim of his black hat and walked out the door alone, vowing that he would begin preparing the next day to reclaim his title 1 year hence. Ed fared even worse. Of the 36 competitors, he was one of only 11 who failed to memorize an entire deck of cards in either of the two speed cards trials, which is like a place kicker missing an extra point twice in a row. He'd been gunning for an especially low time that would take him to the upper ranks, but he'd lost control and burned too hard. He ended up finishing a disappointing 11th place overall and sulked out the door, sodden with sweat. I ran after him and grabbed him to ask what had happened. "Too much ambition," was all he would say, shaking his head. "I'll see you back at the house." He walked across the Magdalen Bridge to go find a pub where he could watch some cricket and drink Guinness until he'd forgotten his failure. Standing at the front of the Oxford Examination Hall, watching the competitors scratch their heads and twiddle their pens as they struggled to recall Miserere, I felt acutely aware of how odd it was that we've come to this, that the only place left where the ancient art of memory is being practiced, or at least celebrated, is in this rarefied competition and among this quirky subculture. Here in one of the world's most storied centers of learning were the last vestiges of a glorious golden age of memory. It is hard not to feel as though a tremendous devolution has taken place between that golden age and our own comparatively leaden one. People used to labor to furnish their minds. They invested in the acquisition of memories, the same way we invest in the acquisition of things. But today, beyond the Oxford Examination Hall's oaken doors, the vast majority of us don't trust our memories. We find shortcuts to avoid relying on them. We complain about them endlessly and see even their smallest lapses as evidence that they're starting to fail us entirely. How did memory, once so essential, end up so marginalized? Why did these techniques disappear? How, I wondered, did our culture end up forgetting how to remember? Chapter 7. The End of Remembering. Once upon a time, there was nothing to do with thoughts except remember them. There was no alphabet to transcribe them in, no paper to set them down upon. Anything that had to be preserved in memory. Any story that would be retold, any idea that would be transmitted, any piece of information that would be conveyed, first had to be remembered. Today, it often seems we remember very little. When I wake up, the first thing I do is check my day planner, which remembers my schedule so that I don't have to. When I climb into my car, I enter my destination into a GPS device whose spatial memory supplants my own. When I sit down to work, I hit the play button on a digital voice recorder or open up a notebook that holds the contents of my interviews. I have photographs to store the images I want to remember, books to store knowledge, and now, thanks to Google, I rarely have to remember anything more than the right set of search terms to access humankind's collective memory. Growing up in the days when you still had to punch 7 buttons or turn a clunky rotary dial to make a telephone call, I could recall the numbers of all my close friends and family. Today, I'm not sure if I know more than 4 numbers by heart, and that's probably more than most. According to a survey conducted in 2007 by a neuropsychologist at Trinity College, Dublin, fully a third of Brits under the age of 30 can't remember even their own home landline number without pulling it up on their handsets. The same survey found that 30% of adults can't remember the birthdays of more than three immediate family members. Our gadgets have eliminated the need to remember such things anymore. Forgotten phone numbers and birthdays represent minor erosions of our everyday memory, but they are part of a much larger story of how we've supplanted our own natural memory with a vast superstructure of technological crutches, from the alphabet to the BlackBerry. These technologies of storing information outside our minds have helped make our modern world possible, but they've also changed how we think and how we use our brains. In Plato's Phaedrus, Socrates describes how the Egyptian god Teuth, inventor of writing, came to Thammuz, the king of Egypt, and offered to bestow his wonderful invention upon the Egyptian people. "Here is a branch of learning that will improve their memories," Teuth said to the Egyptian king. "My discovery provides a recipe for both memory and wisdom." But Thammuz was reluctant to accept the gift. "If men learn this, it will implant forgetfulness in their souls," he told the god. "They will cease to exercise their memory and become forgetful. They will rely on that which is written, calling things to remembrance no longer from within themselves, but by means of external marks. What you have discovered is a recipe not for memory, but for reminding. And it is no true wisdom that you offer your disciples, but only its semblance. For by telling them of many things without teaching them anything, you will make them seem to know much, while for the most part they will know nothing. And as men filled not with wisdom, but with the conceit of wisdom, they will be a burden to their fellow men." Socrates goes on to disparage the idea of passing on his own knowledge through writing, saying it would be singularly simple-minded to believe that written words can do anything more than remind one of what one already knows. Writing, for Socrates, could never be anything more than a cue for memory, a way of calling to mind information already in one's head. Socrates feared that writing would lead the culture down a treacherous path toward intellectual and moral decay. Because even while the quantity of knowledge available to people might increase, they themselves would come to resemble empty vessels. I wonder if Socrates would have appreciated the flagrant irony. It's only because his pupils Plato and Xenophon put his disdain for the written word into written words that we have any knowledge of it today. Socrates lived in the 5th century BC, at a time when writing was ascendant in Greece, and his own views were already becoming antiquated. Why was he so put off by the idea of putting pen to paper? Securing memories on the page would seem to be an immensely superior way of retaining knowledge compared to trying to hold it in the brain. The brain is always making mistakes, forgetting, misremembering. Writing is how we overcome those essential biological constraints. It allows our memories to be pulled out of the fallible wetware of the brain and secured on the less fallible page, where they can be made permanent and, one sometimes hopes, disseminated far, wide, and across time. Writing allows ideas to be passed across generations without fear of the kind of natural mutation that is necessarily a part of oral traditions. To understand why memory was so important in the world of Socrates, we have to understand something about the evolution of writing and how different early books were in both form and function. We have to go back to an age before printing, before indexes and tables of contents, before the codex parceled text into pages and bound them at the edge, before punctuation marks, before lowercase letters, even before there were spaces between words. Today, we write things down precisely so we don't have to hold them in our memories. But through at least the late Middle Ages, books served not as replacements for memory, but rather as memory aids. As Thomas Aquinas put it, Things are written down in material books to help the memory. One read in order to remember, and books were the best available tools for impressing information into the mind. In fact, manuscripts were often copied for no reason other than to help their copier memorize them. In the time of Socrates, Greek texts were written on long, continuous scrolls, some stretching up to 60 feet, pasted together from sheets of pressed papyrus reeds imported from the Nile Delta. These texts were cumbersome to read, and even more cumbersome to write. It would be tough to invent a less user-friendly way of accessing information. In fact, it wasn't until about 200 BC that the most basic punctuation marks were invented by Aristophanes of Byzantium, the director of the Library of Alexandria. And all they consisted of was a single dot at either the bottom, middle, or top of the line, letting readers know how long to pause between sentences. Instead, words ran together in an unending stream of capital letters known as scriptio continua, broken up by neither spaces nor punctuation. Words that started on one line would spill over onto the next without even a hyphen. Unlike the letters in this book, which form words that carry semantic meaning, letters written in scriptio continua function more like musical notes. They signified the sounds that were meant to come out of one's mouth. Reconstituting those sounds into discrete packets of words that could be understood first required hearing them. And just as it is difficult for all but the most gifted musicians to read musical notes without actually singing them, so too was it difficult to read texts written in scriptio continua without speaking them aloud. In fact, we know that well into the Middle Ages, reading was an activity almost always carried out aloud, a kind of performance, and one most often given before an audience. "Lend ears" is a phrase often repeated in medieval texts. When St. Augustine, in the 4th century AD, observed his teacher St. Ambrose reading to himself without moving his tongue or murmuring, he thought the unusual behavior so noteworthy as to record it in his Confessions. It was probably not until about the 9th century, around the same time that spacing became common and the catalog of punctuation marks grew richer, that the page provided enough information for silent reading to become common. The difficulties associated with reading such texts meant that there was a very different relationship between reading and memory than the one we know today. Since sight reading scriptio continua was difficult, reciting a text aloud with fluency required a reader to have a degree of familiarity with it. He, and it was mostly he's, had to prepare with it, punctuate it in his mind, memorize it, in part, if not in full, because turning a string of sounds into meaning was not something you could do easily on the fly. The text had to be learned before it could be performed. After all, the way one punctuated a text written in scriptio continua could make all the difference in the world. As the historian Jocelyn Penny Small pointed out, G-O-D-I-S-N-O-W-H-E-R-E comes out a lot differently when rendered as "God is now here" versus "God is nowhere." What's more, a scroll written in scriptio continua had to be read top to bottom if anything was to be taken from it. A scroll has just a single point of entry, the first word. Because it has to be unwound to be read, and because there are no punctuation marks or paragraphs to break up the text, to say nothing of page numbers, a table of contents, chapter divisions, and an index, it is impossible to find a specific piece of information without scanning the whole thing, head to toe. It is not a text that can be easily consulted until it is memorized. This is a key point. Ancient texts couldn't be readily scanned. You couldn't pull a scroll off the shelf and quickly find a specific excerpt unless you had some baseline familiarity with the entire text. The scroll existed not to hold its contents externally, but rather to help its reader navigate its contents internally. One of the last places where this tradition of recitation still survives is in the reading of the Torah, an ancient handwritten scroll that can take upward of a year to inscribe. The Torah is written without vowels or punctuation, though it does have spaces, an innovation that came to Hebrew before Greek, which means it's extremely difficult to sight-read. Though Jews are specifically commanded not to recite the Torah from memory, there's no way to read a section of the Torah without having invested a lot of time familiarizing yourself with it. As any once bar mitzvah boy can tell you, I can personally vouch for this. On the day I became a man, I was really just a parrot in a yarmulke. Though years of language use condition us not to notice, scriptio continua has more in common with the way we actually speak than the artificial word divisions on this page. Spoken sentences flow together seamlessly as one long, blurry, drawn-out sound. We don't speak with spaces. Where one word ends and another begins is a relatively arbitrary linguistic convention. If you look at a sonographic chart visualizing the sound waves of someone speaking English, it's practically impossible to tell where the spaces are, which is one of the reasons why it's proven so difficult to train computers to recognize speech. Without sophisticated artificial intelligence capable of figuring out context, a computer has no way of telling the difference between "the stuff he knows made dim liquor" and "the stuff he knows made him liquor." For a period, Latin scribes actually did try separating words with dots. But in the 2nd century AD, there was a reversion, a giant and very curious step backward, it would seem, to the old continuous script used by the Greeks. Spaces weren't seen again in Western writing for another 900 years. From our vantage point today, separating words seems like a no-brainer. But the fact that it was tried and rejected says a lot about how people used to read. So too does the fact that the ancient Greek word most commonly used to signify to read was anagignosko, which means to know again or to recollect. Reading as an act of remembering, from our modern vantage point, could there be a more unfamiliar relationship between reader and text? Today, when we live amid a deluge of printed words, would you believe that 10 billion volumes were printed last year? It's hard to imagine what it must have been like to read in the age before Gutenberg, when a book was a rare and costly handwritten object that could take a scribe months of labor to produce. Even as late as the 15th century, there might be just several dozen copies of any given text in existence, and those copies were quite probably chained to a desk or lectern in some university library, which, if it contained 100 other books, would have been considered particularly well-stocked. If you were a medieval scholar reading a book, you knew that there was a reasonable likelihood that you'd never see that particular text again, and so a high premium was placed on remembering what you read. You couldn't just pull a book off the shelf to consult it for a quote or an idea. For one thing, modern bookshelves with their own rows of outward-facing spines hadn't even been invented yet. That didn't happen until sometime around the 16th century. For another thing, books still tended to be heavy, hardly portable objects. It was only in the 13th century that bookmaking technology advanced to the point that the Bible could be compiled in a single volume rather than a collection of independent books. And yet it still weighed more than 10 pounds. And even if you did happen to have a text you needed close at hand, the chances of finding what you were looking for without reading the whole thing start to finish were slim. Indexes were not yet common, nor were page numbers or tables of contents. But these gaps were gradually filled. And as the book itself changed, so too did the crucial role of memory in reading. By about the year 400, the parchment codex, with its leaves of pages bound at the spine like a modern hardcover, had all but completely replaced scrolls as the preferred way to read. No longer did a reader have to unfurl a long document to find a passage. A reader could just turn to the appropriate page, the first concordance of the Bible, a grand index that consumed the labors of 500 Parisian monks, was compiled in the 13th century, around the same time that chapter divisions were introduced. For the first time, a reader could refer to the Bible without having previously memorized it. One could find a passage without knowing it by heart or reading the text all the way through. Soon after the concordance, other books with alphabetical indexes, page numbers, and tables of contents began to appear. And as they did, they again helped change the essence of what a book was. The problem of the book before the index and table of contents is that for all the material contained in a scroll or between the covers of a book, it was impossible to navigate. What makes the brain such an incredible tool is not just the sheer volume of information it contains, but the ease and efficiency with which it can find that information. It uses the greatest random access indexing system ever invented, one that computer scientists haven't come even close to replicating. Whereas an index in the back of a book provides a single address, a page number for each important subject, each subject in the brain has hundreds, if not thousands, of addresses. Our internal memories are associational, non-linear. You don't need to know where a particular memory is stored in order to find it. It simply turns up, or doesn't, when you need it. Because of the dense network that interconnects our memories, we can skip around from memory to memory and idea to idea very rapidly. From Barry White to the color white, to milk to the Milky Way, is a long voyage conceptually, but a short jaunt neurologically. Indexes were a major advance because they allowed books to be accessed in the non-linear way we access our internal memories. They helped turn the book into something like a modern CD, where you can skip directly to the track you want, as compared to unindexed books, which, like cassette tapes, force you to troll laboriously through large swaths of material in order to find the bit you're looking for. Along with page numbers and tables of contents, the index changed what a book was and what it could do for scholars. The historian Ivan Illich has argued that this represented an invention of such magnitude that it seems reasonable to speak of the pre- and the post-index Middle Ages. As books became easier and easier to consult, the imperative to hold their contents in memory became less and less relevant, and the very notion of what it meant to be erudite began to evolve from processing information internally to knowing where to find information in the labyrinthine world of external memory. To our memory-bound predecessors, the goal of training one's memory was not to become a living book, but rather a living concordance, a walking index of everything one had read and all the information one had acquired. It was about more than merely possessing an internal library of facts, quotes, and ideas. It was about building an organizational scheme for accessing them. Consider, for example, Peter of Ravenna, a leading 15th century Italian jurist, also, one gets the impression, one of the 15th century's leading self-promoters, who authored one of the era's most successful books on memory training. Titled Phoenix, it was translated into several languages and reprinted all across Europe. It was just the most famous of a handful of memory treatises created from the 13th century onward that helped make memory techniques that had long been the exclusive purview of scholars and monks available to a wider audience of doctors, lawyers, tradesmen, and everyday folks who just wanted to remember stuff. One finds books from the period on every variety of mnemonic subject, including how to use the art of memory in gambling, how to use it to keep track of debts, how to memorize the contents of ships, how to remember the names of acquaintances, and how to memorize playing cards. Peter, for his part, bragged of having memorized 20,000 legal points, 1,000 texts by Ovid, 200 of Cicero's speeches and sayings, 300 sayings of philosophers, 7,000 texts from Scripture, as well as a host of other classical works. For leisure, He would reread books cached away in his many memory palaces. When I left my country to visit as a pilgrim the cities of Italy, I can truly say I carried everything I owned.